And so we reach a two-parter in terms of origins of modern Britain, commencing actually with the swing 60s, which the official line went, if you could remember the 60s, you weren't really there. Why then was London so swinging in the 60s? What do we mean by the swinging 60s and so on? If you ever took the time to actually watch Billy Liar, you may recall that at the end of the film, Billy is too scared to actually leave the working class north. So effectively portrayed within the new wave cultures of the time and the angry young men of the time. But his girlfriend actually got on the train to London. In other words, it was a clear, unambiguous statement that the 60s had actually arrived and London was beginning to swing. Humour and aspects relating to culture and Britishness. Or do we? Well, what I'm going to actually talk you through over the next 45 to 50 minutes is some of the ideas, some of the concepts that actually go on to relate to this whole notion of London in particular. Because actually when it comes to other parts of the country, it's fair to say that maybe things weren't as swinging as perhaps we are led to believe. So, first question, why did it actually swing in the 1960s? Why was it seen as groovy and an essential part of the place to actually be? Well, we saw in terms of Georgie Girl, the whole notion of British film. We also looked at British film in terms of Look Back and Anger, but that wasn't really very successful. And what we begin to see 20 years after the Second World War is this gradual fusion of art, of fashion, of photography, music, and film, all combining to produce this advertising and retail culture. And in many ways, we're still experiencing 60 years after the 60s, 50 years after the 60s, in the 2010s and the 2020s, no doubt. Although the Look Back and Anger branch of new wave writers didn't prove to be too huge successful, the British film industry itself was gradually beginning to find its feet again. it had been in terminal decline since the Second World War. And certainly, as we said a few weeks ago, the New Wave films didn't really help in terms of box office because they were seen as too depressing and too miserable and not really competitive with the Hollywood Dream Factory. But other films, certainly under the ever-expanding Hammer horror area, were much more successful. Hammer Studios had actually gained the rights to remake a series of 1930s black and white classic Universal horror movies, including Dracula, Frankenstein, and so on, with the added advantage of obviously putting them in Technicolor. You could see the gore, see the blood, and so on. Now, these early films didn't do that well because they were X certificate, which is the equivalent of today's 18 certificate, so they weren't family films, but they did actually provide a platform for Hammer horror to become much more successful, and certainly by the late 60s up to the present day, they'd achieved cult status. People look back fondly over Hammer horror and Hammer Studios and the kind of aspects that Hammer were actually producing. So why were they so popular? Well, it's been theorised that they were escapist in a gothic horror manner. So classic gothic escapism. They were sexually very permissive. They were about stylish fantasies featuring folk who did what they liked and weren't much concerned about larger world issues. So if you're worried about the Suez Canal crisis or immigration or indeed Britain's place in the world, post-Second World War, actually, you could lose yourself in the escapist world of Hammer horror. And the protagonists, in the main, were out to satisfy their own needs and their own desires, which, in many ways, seemed to fit with the outlook of the young at the time. Young, basically, being under 20, or early 20s, and so on. Three major box office winners, or fundamental winners in terms of the 1960s, we'll talk about at the end of the session. But one of the key areas, in terms of hugely successful across the board, was of course the Ian Fleming creation, James Bond. Pop quiz question, and I will provide a coffee, cappuccino, latte, or indeed drink of one person's choice. If anybody in the room can actually tell me the name of the character and the name of the actress. Nobody's googling either, so that's very good. Name of the character, Sylvia Trench. She has the honour of basically being the first person to actually force Sean Connery to utter the words Bond, James Bond. Name of the actress, Eunice Gayson. Still actually alive, and originally designed to be a regular character, a girlfriend for Bond. She only appeared basically in the first two films, however. This, of course, was the opening one, Dr. No. Now, Bond in itself was a fantasy. Ian Fleming, who'd worked as a spy in the Second World War, was quite explicit in terms of creating this fantasy male character. It didn't hinder the situation that John F. Kennedy allegedly kept a copy of the first Bond novel, Casino Royale, as essential bedtime reading. And certainly the top earning 1960s films across the generations were indeed the James Bond films. It's nip and tuck basically between James Bond and Harry Potter in terms of what the most successful film franchise is, and obviously we've got the Star Wars aspect in there as well, and arguably the Marvel Comics world as well. But in terms of regularly re-emerging, repackaged areas, Bond is certainly well up there. And both Dr. No and its successor From Russia with Love featured British production teams. Co-production between Albert Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, who again, if you recall, also produced Look Back in Anger. So we had a British production, British crews, and a British cast, led by the Scotsman Sean Connery. However, in order to create this dynamic wish fulfillment, this exotic range of images and packages from Jamaica to Istanbul to Fort Knox to the Caribbean to Japan and so on, in terms of the locations, clearly money was required. and that money came from American capital and also American investors. So you could quite categorically say that the thing about James Bond is that the whole film process is an American-British hybrid. And in the main, the Americans would get the profits. Britain, as a film industry, couldn't compete with American capital, and because it lacked any state backing or funding from Parliament or from the government, it didn't have any capital to actually develop, unlike other European countries as well. So there was always a case of tight budgets and problems with respect to that issue. However, the Bond films have become iconic. They open up a whole range of fantasies and developments and aspects relating to the title, the theme, a whole range of aspects, as this actually would demonstrate from Bond number 2. Terence Young, who also directed Dr. No, was very much an English gentleman, seen very much as very much focusing on the class system and so on. But if you compare the opening credits to From Russia with Love, any of the Bond credits, isn't it nice to know that those pesky Russians are still poisoning people, thereby promoting the whole notion of a Cold War and an epic of contemporary productions? We still get this whole notion of fantasy and elements within that. And ultimately some kind of fantasy which maybe, just maybe, still actually suggests that there is a position for Britain as some kind of sophisticated player in world politics.
Man has climbed Mount Everest, gone to the bottom of the ocean, has fired rockets to hope, drink up, achieve miracles.
Beyond overseas. I think it's time, Mr. Goldfinger, and I met
Tell Senor. They'll be watching. True short next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond, it may be your last.
Seminar. In any way, what we've got here is classic iconography, classic cinematic iconography. And the Bond films are clearly iconic, all 25 of them, 25 in the process. American consumerism is very much in full flow, and James Bond is the ultimate male consumer. He wears expensive designer clothes, he jets from exotic location to exotic location, and the plots of the movies are very much spectacular, with lots of promiscuity and lots of glamorous 1960s women. Bond will drink martinis, he'll eat gourmet food, and in a culture which is increasingly concerned and occupied by materialism, worldly success and sex, Bond is the ultimate expression of this consumerist fantasy, and everyone would flock to the cinema to actually catch the latest Bond movie, whether it was Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, and even the first one to star, not Sean Connery, but George Lazenby on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Lots of replica spy films are being made at the same time. Lots of other sort of characters coming to play our man Flint, and as with all successes, this kind of opens up a whole range of other elements. Harry Saltzman, who is the Canadian producer, again responsible for co-producing the Bond series, also made a series of films based on another character called The Ypres File, which actually starred Michael Caine. Which, to a certain extent, was a more surrealist take on spy, if you like, but again, it also tied into the whole notion of the surreality of the time. It was a bit like The Avengers, with some typical 1960s psychedelic moments. Because the other thing, which again we'll talk about slightly more fully next week, is there is a drug culture that's becoming very much embedded in terms of society as well within the 1960s. As the Californian Berkeley professor Timothy O'Leary would say, tune in, turn on, and drop out. The Ypres File, which opened in 1965, produced by Harry Saltzman, went on to spawn two more sequels, Funeral in Berlin and Billion Dollar Brain, and they were based on novels by Len Deighton about a spy called Harry Palmer. But the film that really launched Michael Caine as a 60s icon himself, standing up alongside Sean Connery, was Alfie. 1966, England have won the Football World Cup, and Michael Caine has emerged as this Jack the Lad, Cockney lad, called Alfie. Alfie is pretty much a British film that's based about sex and permissiveness amongst the young. Alfie's only goal is sex. He can't make relationships. He isn't interested in anything except promiscuity. And effectively, at the end, he's left with nothing. It's actually quite a strange account of a new age character in a counter-cultural setting. The final message, as revolved around the Cilla Black song, is what's it all about, Alfie?
Get your knee off the steering wheel.
I can't, I'm stuck.
Here, look out, I'll do it.
Oh!
Well, you'll tell me. Right, we can begin. My name is...
Alfie,
bubbles with impudent humor and ripe modern wit, says the New York Times.
I was having a beautiful little night. There was this manageress of a dry cleaner's. that I was getting a suit cleaned in the bargain.
Everybody's running after Alfie.
Didn't
that mean? What can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
All right, come with me.
Michael Caine gives a brilliant performance, says Red Book magazine. Is Alfie really as good as all that?
Now, what's your ticket back?
Shelley Winters thinks so.
Now, what's your address?
Alfie returns the compliment.
She's in lovely condition.
Condition is everything in life.
I'll just get you ready for your injection, Mr. Elkins.
Oh, thank you, nurse.
The New York Daily News gives Alfie 4 stars and says that people are going to stop talking about who's afraid of Virginia Woolf and start talking about Alfie.
Hello?
Alfie, a delightful comedy. A direct hit. Presented in the best of humor and with complete frankness, says the New York Post. Michael Caine is superb, says the Saturday Review. Alfie, you might say, has it made?
Alfie, what's it all about? Alfie. Is it just for the moment we live?
I've had a lovely time, Alfie.
As Life magazine puts it, you are going to enjoy Alfie very much.
Okay, so again, you're getting messages that are being rolled out in terms of Britain is, on one level at least, beginning to actually open itself up to the swinging 60s and so on. As you saw there, Alfie won an award at the Cannes Film Festival. It received several Academy Award nominations, and it also put Michael Caine on the international stage. Other notable films of the 60s included what we actually launched with, which was Georgie Girl, again in which a good-looking but shallow 1960s girl portrayed by Charlotte Rampling has a promiscuous lifestyle, has a baby, and abandons the child to her plain, plump flatmate that we saw in the trailer, portrayed by Lynn Redgrave. Why did she abandon the child? Well, so that she could go back to enjoying her hedonistic 1960s lifestyle. Blow Up in 1966 also starred David Hemmings in a crossover to a variety of other elements, in which Hemmings actually played a life of a photographer based on a real-life fashion photographer, David Bailey. This was very much seen as a way of conveying the glamorous world of swinging London. It had the beautiful people. It had Vanessa Redgrave, Jane Birkin. It had female nudity. It had far-out experiences. And it showed people who were having problems with the sensation-filmed world in which they lived in. And this was an Italian
thing. Sometimes, reality is the strangest fantasy of all.
The protest aspects that we saw there in a little bit more detail next week. But Alfie, to Antonioni's blow-up. Nevertheless, we're getting a general pattern, which probably isn't being replicated in Lincoln at the time, but it's certainly putting the whole notion of British culture on the map in terms of popular culture, at least. So, was this something which was real? Or was it simply, if we're adopting a very cynical approach, some way of actually getting people to buy more movie tickets on the basis of the promise of what might be delivered, or buy more books, etc., etc., and get involved with fashion and so on? Well, in terms of the fashion industry, the whole notion of Britain at the heart of the fashion world would have been something that would have been laughed at in the 1950s, even before that. Fashion was something for Rome, Paris, and New York. The notion of a London Fashion Week would actually have been seen as ridiculous. But even though the Americans had pulled out of the film industry by the end of the 60s, and the British film industry again was faced with everything but collapse, Britain was nevertheless back on the culture map, and it was competing in the wider world. And the British fashion industry began to show signs of life. As teenagers were increasingly becoming consumers, fashion was obviously becoming big business in both America and in Europe. And there were three major British designers of the period. The first one we see up there, Mary Quant. Mary Quant trained at the University of London. She opened a boutique in King's Road in 1955. Although she's credited with inventing the miniskirt, it's not necessarily guaranteed that she did invent the miniskirt, but she did undoubtedly popularise it. As well as the look of androgynous, skinny models, especially Twiggy, pinafore dresses, skinny rib sweaters, and white collars. In other words, once you've actually seen the Mary Quant look, it's very identifiable. Another major winner of the time, Barbara Holonicki. Barbara was a Polish immigrant. She studied design at the Brighton School of Art. Remember what we talked about in terms of colleges of art being a place which often people would actually go to express themselves and so on. And she began selling her product through mail order. She founded Biba in 1964. Then it became, from a mail order product, a huge shop on High Street, Kensington, that sold everything. It sold tie-dye t-shirts, it sold feather boas, makeup, velvet trousers. It was very much a place where the beautiful people and the famous would actually go to get kitted out. And Biba effectively stayed open from 1964 to 1976. Ozzie Clark, not Ozzie Clark, but Twiggy, Ozzie Clark there, was so successful in the mid-1960s that his designs also made it in New York. Ozzie was the first British clothes designer to have an impact in both Europe and America. And Ozzie lived the hedonistic lifestyle to the full. As well as dressing the rich and famous, he took drugs, although his career declined in the 1970s with drug addiction, bankruptcies, several attempted comebacks, and finally being stabbed to death by his lover in 1996. Also noteworthy at the time was John Stephen, a gay designer from Glasgow, who created Carnaby Street. He opened a string of boutiques to cater for the young who were seeking trendy fashions. And Carnaby Street in itself, as a name in London, became as famous as the King's Road in Chelsea, with the result that John Stephen made a fortune. Britain also became better known for exporting models. In addition to Twiggy, there was Jean Shrimpton, who also made money too. Now, Britain could never compete necessarily with the great European and American fashion houses, but for a while in the 1960s, London was very much one of the places to be. Perhaps more important, though, than film and fashion put together, in terms of this fusion side of things, was the greatest British merchandising opportunity of the 1960s. Four lads from Liverpool, there they are, the Beatles. So, how do these guys enter the picture? But by 1963, the Beatles were the preeminent youth band in Britain. If we forget One Direction, take that, any of the other sort of incarnations over the decades since, even Oasis and Blur and so on, these were very much the granddaddies of success when it comes to really winning popular culture. By September 1963, both She Loves You, Please Please Me and Twist and Shout were all in the charts. In October, the Beatles were booked to appear on the hugely successful television show Saturday Night at the London Palladium, which is the top-rated variety show at the time. The event got front-page coverage. In other words, unlike the Mods and Rockers, where you actually had moral panics and various other elements, this was clearly an example of teenage culture finally making it into the mainstream of British life. Now, there are lots of debates about how Beatlemania as a phenomenon was developed. According to the Daily Mirror, outside the London Palladium, there were 60 police who fought to hold back 1,000 screaming fans on the pavement outside. A similar picture in the Daily Mail shows three girls and one policeman. But whatever the truth, Beatlemania had actually been born, either out of the marketing genius of the manager Brian Epstein, or indeed out of something which was immediately going to tap into people's cultures and so on. In November, the Beatles appeared at the Royal Variety Command performance, which was an annual event. By now, there were thousands of screaming fans, and 500 additional police for every particular appearance by the Beatles became a reality. 26 million people actually watched the programme. Now, it's fair to say that not everybody admired the Beatles. Many people thought that the Beatles represented the ugly face of an affluent, consumer-led culture. They had long hair and provincial accents. They were cheeky. Their manager was grasping, all about money and commercialisation. And the public appearances also reminded people of the Nuremberg rallies, with large crowds of hysterical girls who didn't seem able to think for themselves, who would scream mindlessly over dire lyrics, whether that happened to be Love Me Do, or indeed Please Please Me.
The younger generation is going to hell.
Nostalgias. What? Nostalgias.
The haircuts, the clothes they say, the fashion, dryer things, and clouds, the hair. It's very different.
And they're confident they're natural.
They feel happy that they get a speech.
At the end, it became quite complicated, but at the beginning, things were really simple.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you very much.
A lot of people thought we were an overnight sensation. We weren't. People didn't realize we had all this development. They just saw these four things that looked alike with this haircut. And they knew how to play. And they were a bit of a laugh. You know, because that's what we've been doing all those years previously.
I had a group. I was the singer and the leader. I met Paul, said, do you want to join the band? No. And then George, do you want? We were great live performers then. I don't think anybody in the world ever saw us outside of Liverpool in a few places where we travelled to, because that's when we had to perform live to a small audience in the dance where we had to hold them.
We were just playing all the time. Then we went out to Hamburg, and that was a real slog. We were playing sometimes 8 hours a day.
I was lying in the middle of the naughtiest city in the world. 17 years old, it was kind of exciting.
As with Rory Storm, we were like the top band in Liverpool, and for some reason this guy in Hamburg decided to come to Liverpool and take all the bands to Germany to play. Well, we went to see these punks, and that was it.
I still remember that moment the first time Ringo played with us. Kicks in, it's like, wow. And it was an oh my god moment, but I remember looking and we're all looking at each other like, yeah, this is it. I get very emotional.
once we got Ringo, they started to do it better and sort of do it professionally.
You know, for me, I'm an only child. I felt like I suddenly had three brothers.
We just wanted to play. Playing was the most important thing.
Hamburg was a bit messy, you know, having to sleep all huddled together in one room. No bathroom or anything, but then we'd had practice because we didn't have a bathroom at home.
We used to have this saying that I used to chant and they would answer. When they were depressed, you know, thinking the group was going nowhere, and this is a shitty deal, and we're in a shitty dressing room, I said, where are we going, fellas? And they go,
to the top, Jolly.
And I said, where's that, fellas? And they say,
to the topmost and the bottommost, Jolly.
And I said, right. And we all sort of cheer up.
We were always kind of, you know, a little nervous before each step we went up the ladder. But we didn't realize what was to come.
Last night I said these words to my
The Beatles. In one meteoric year, they led the way from the cellars of Melbourne to the national limelight.
You haven't cleared that your public eventually will move on to a new paper.
It's too worried when things are not.
It's not worth missing your sleep for it.
No,
I'm worried now.
It could have been tomorrow, and it could, you know, you could have quite a lot.
I was living in Sweden, and the Beatles came to Sweden. And I remember I went day after day and stood outside the hotel at the end of school. And I just remember seeing their figures on the balcony. Once a day, the Beatles would come out and wave.
Hello, my name's Paul McCartney and I play bass guitar.
Hello, people, look. I'm George Harrison and I play solo guitar. Yeah.
This is Ringo Starr and I play drums.
And this is John Lennon and I play better guitar.
They were like a gang. Do you know what I mean? They each had their little characteristic. I mean, John was surprisingly fearless. Paul was surprisingly cute. Ringo was cheeky and irresistible, and George was the one that my sister was in love with.
I had tremendously lively and full of zing on the stage. How difficult is it for you to keep up the zest?
Well, we do the zest we can.
I've spent my whole career, in a way, trying to recapture in things that I write the hilarity of four friends, one drink down, age 19, laughing at their jokes and all the new stuff that they find really funny. The Beatles were kind of the dream of how you might be with your friends as you went through life.
Oh, screaming, screaming, that's
what
I'm saying. You say, why do they scream?
I don't know, I couldn't tell you. As loose goes the girl, there's a louder cheer from all the people. So if we shaved our heads, it's the equivalent of scoring a goal, and that's the one that screams the loudest. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, yes, I do understand. You do that and they scream.
But was the work of the Beatles as empty of culture and meaning as some of the critics actually suggested? Well, a couple of things you need to take into account when you're asking the question, how do you actually see the Beatles, who undoubtedly financial were a huge success, and we'll go on in the seminar to discuss why they went global and managed to tap into the United States market as well. And effectively, first of those is the gap between high culture and commerce. Because that began to disappear in the 1960s. The suggestion that actually there was a canon of good quality books and music and art forms that critics would recognise as being unambiguously high art tended to vanish. Artists like Andy Warhol in America, Peter Blake and Richard Hamilton in Britain were very happy to use their work commercially. Both Warhol and Blake created famous album covers. In the case of Blake, it was the Sgt. Pepper album. And also, the notion of throwaway art in areas such as advertisements was also very much accepted as part and parcel of the culture. David Bailey, who was a renowned art photographer, would regularly photograph celebrities for glossy magazines. And in music itself, jazz had already bridged the gap between highbrow and lowbrow cultures. We spoke earlier in this particular module about the expansion of education. And as part of a result of that expansion of education, art schools had actually multiplied. And the agenda of the Arts Council in Britain was very much about promoting new, young, contemporary artists. People were less concerned about the merits of the art, but they were more concerned about the fact that here was a new generation who were having the opportunity to study art regardless of their social class. This all resulted in a political, social policy agenda which effectively gave rise, ultimately, to the concept of pop art. In the 1960s, again, we've got this whole notion of Britishness and Americanness. And again, we'll start exploring the whole notion of how this taps in to the Beatles' bond we've already looked at. But clearly we have a whole notion of fashion, art, and music combining to actually create and sell a lifestyle. This was not new. The Americans had arguably done this a generation previously. But for Britain, this was the first time that connection between the teenage culture, celebrities, and art were being synthesized together. And many iconic pop stars came from the art schools of the period. In addition to John Lennon and Paul McCartney, there was Eric Clapton, the lead singer of the Kinks, Ray Davis, Viv Stansall from Bonzo Dog Band, Eric Burdon from The Animals, Pete Townsend from The Who, David Bowie, David Jones and so on, all connected within that whole aspect. So let's try and define the term. Let's actually ask ourselves the question, what is pop art? This thing that we see developed by Lichtenstein and the whole notion of art as well, which arguably also tied in with comic book art, the whole notion of the Marvel Comics Empire, DC Comics and so on. Writers and artists like Steranko, Stan Lee, and their equivalents. Well, according to Richard Hamilton, pop art actually defined in 1957 was as follows. It was popular, it was transient, it was expendable, it was low cost, it was mass-produced, it was young, it was witty, it was sexy, it was gimmicky, and it was glamorous. So a whole range of things there that Hamilton's talking about. It's popular, it's transient, it's expendable, it's low cost, it's mass-produced, it's young, witty, sexy, gimmicky, and glamorous. It's very saleable, very now, very of the moment. You buy it, you throw it away. And pop art in many ways became emblematic of the period, and it drove a thriving market of art dealers and galleries. However, it was criticised because it fully supported affluent consumerism and had very little other message. In other words, it was seen as boring and shallow. But maybe that's an age thing. You know, somebody can actually look in their 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s saying, where's the essence? What's the message here? What are they saying? How are they actually trying to open up a new generation and so on? Actually, art had in the 1960s become democratized. More people had access to designing art and living with art than ever before. In 1964, Terence Conran opened the first ever Habitat store in Fulham Road, Chelsea. This was designed to market his own range of modern designer furniture. Conran would effectively sell everything that you needed to live in a modern designer household. He would sell furniture, he would sell kitchen equipment, and he would sell lamps. But interestingly, the most successful product that he actually sold was pasta jars. Jars to actually store pasta in. Why? Because young people were beginning to experiment with new continental tastes. Remember 1958 saw the opening of the first ever Chinese takeaway. People would criticise the music of the time, particularly the Beatles, and they'd criticise the music on the basis of, well, it's not socially relevant. The music itself was shallow. It was easy to understand. Again, the simplicity of the early work of the Beatles. It wasn't until part two where we start seeing the latter stages that they started beginning to get a little bit more sophisticated in terms of the productions and the areas and the psychedelic elements of that whole area. But clearly, in the opening stages of the 60s, Beatles and Bond, as our two most successful British exports, were making money. In fact, everyone was making money. Britain was being seen as cool again. We might not have an empire, but at least we were financially doing very well. And is there anything wrong with that? The country at the time, white heat of technology, Harold Wilson referred to it as being. It was a swinging country, it was affluent. We weren't bogged down in a war in Vietnam. We were aware of the Vietnamese War. We were aware of the Cold War. But effectively, we were doing our own thing. The music was shallow, it was easy to understand. And many people were having a great time chasing the fashions. However, behind all of that, there was still dissatisfaction. Vietnam, as I mentioned, was rumbling on. There is a suggestion that in terms of Bond, what we have there is misogyny carried to the silver screen in Technicolor. It takes an awfully long time before you actually get any female characters who effectively are not, in the case of Pussy Galore in the original novel, deemed as being a lesbian if they don't instantly fall for the charms, quote-unquote, of Bond, the superstar. And the superstud, arguably. America was also becoming an increasingly vocal framework for gay rights, for civil rights, which we'd already, again, we've looked at in previous sessions. And also there was a general consensus over civil rights issues. I want to actually sort of bridge this particular piece by returning to, again, the whole notion of pop art and wrapping up with the whole notion of Yellow Submarine, which in many ways, although it didn't feature the voices of the Beatles, simply had people who were actually taking on board the routine, opened up a whole range of popular cultural throwaway art.
Nothing is real. The Beatles. Yellow Submarine. Landscapes painted with Beatles sound.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
We all live in the Yellow Submarine.
The Yellow Submarine.
The Yellow Submarine.
The forces of good. The Beatles. The Boo.
Complete my
past.
Two novels, finish my blueprints, begin my
beginning. Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
If I spoke prose, you'd all find out. I don't know what I talk about.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land.
The forces of ego, Robin, the butterfly stomping, snapping turtle turks, the apple barkers, the terrible flying glove, the arch villain, the blue meanie.
The crash of the original.
We are the original.
Yes.
Blue Amigas have been sighted within the vicinity of this theatre. Oh, there's only one way to go out. How's that?
Singing!
One, two,
three,
four!
And assuming you don't get struck by the blue meanies between now and the seminar, I will see you then. Make sure you sign the register as well.